speak with a thorough understanding. If, as it is, I understand on occasion that some take the position that no white people can be trusted, I can empathize with that, but I think it is a gravely dangerous position to take. Let's just look at it pragmatically. Look at it from a practical standpoint. In a nation where there are 200 million people and 180 million are white, if all those whites are indeed devils, and you divide a line in which you cannot cooperate, it seems to me that that kind of philosophy will lead to nothing but a dead-end street. 20 million people, I don't care if Allah or whoever's on their side, 20 million people are not going to be able to defeat 180 million people. There's no chance of that. Let's just look at it from a practical standpoint, if wanted to be a tactical strategist on a battlefield. But I don't intend to look at life like that. I know the backbone of this church, when we have been in civil rights fights, have not been any more black than white. Some of the most principled people, one of them 90-some years of age, sitting in this congregation somewhere, who has fought, B. Whitner, who has fought for principles, sitting back there, who's fought to the point of even going to jail. She's very much white, very much Irish, and I think it's stupid to make a categorization about any race of people. That's what we've been fighting. As an Indian, I've been fighting that all my life, to say all Indians are bad or all blacks are bad, and I, in all due respect, and I respect the feeling of pride that the Nation of Islam has given, but when it says that all whites are wrong, are bad, are devils, are shaitans, then I say at that point I must wholeheartedly disagree. Now we do all we can to foster peace, and we feel that it is important to do so. For instance, we tell the people there is someone in our halls every evening from the Nation of Islam selling their paper. They were in the streets. We said, no, come inside. We welcome you. We don't want you to feel that alienation that you've known in the past. We welcome you inside to sell your piece of paper or your news or your periodical. And the black self-help store, we feel that that's very good in this neighborhood. We need to give all kinds of encouragement to black businesses. And we feel we should help one another. And when we want to choose something to eat, if you would follow the general consensus of the council here and the leadership, we say go down to that lovely little shop that's run by the Muslims on the corner. But just because I buy their sandwiches or buy their paper does not mean that I buy everything they preach. I don't know whether I answer your particular persuasion, but I feel it's foolhardy. In fact, I feel it's tragedy, because they are doing so many wonderful things, and they have encompassed now people of my background. I could become a Muslim tomorrow. I've been invited to see the messenger, Muhammad, and I may very well do that, because I certainly want to get to know everyone in various stratum and walks of life. And as I was speaking the other day with Dr. Goodland, no doubt history will show that Mr. Muhammad, the messenger of Allah as he sees himself, has done more, I suppose, than any person today to give black people a sense of pride and cohesiveness. He has built communities and businesses, and he's inspired a feeling of pride, I think, that all of us look to with great satisfaction. And I cannot really say that they're preaching hate. I hear that they preach hate. I do not know that they preach hate. I know when I met with the local representative, Representative John Muhammad, and we ate at their request at a restaurant with Mr. Stone, who is Caucasian, finely committed man, and another Caucasian black person was integrated group. I sense no racial hostilities. I think many of their conclusions have been formed because they feel from their own empirical or experiential evidence that whites cannot be trusted. I think if more white people would make an attempt to show the Muslims they could be trusted, the Muslims might change some of their attitudes. I think we have to awaken to the fact, and I look down upon those who are interracially married, and I know in my own black adopted son, some of you can't possibly know what this is unless you are either black, and then even more so, people, as the former speaker, who he and his wife have lived these beautiful years, 20, they had to be in love. You can't live, an interracial couple can't live 25, 26, 27 years. They really have to have something on the ball. They won't stay together that long. Because most of the marriages that I've known who've attempted to cross ethnic lines, it's a tough battle to hurdle. You find yourself uncomfortable. Unfortunately and tragically, you find yourself uncomfortable not only sometimes in the white world, but I know interracial couples who are here who have gone to black churches and the white partner has been shunned in black churches just as well as the black person has been shunned in the white community. And I think we need to be vividly aware of these racial antipathies. No use to go around with an Uncle Tomish attitude and say that they don't exist. No use to try to make us believe at this hour, with my background of experiences, that race doesn't enter into every arena. For instance, I know of all kinds of ministers who are doing nothing for their people, driving in expensive cars. I only own one suit, and it's a used suit. I own one suit to my name. You see it every time you see it. Same tie, same suit. And recently we saw what a newsman can do. Now, I'm confident that if I had been white and this church had been middle class white, but because we were doing something for the average man, reaching the black and the brown and the poor whites, that newsman took pot shots and he told fabrications. That's what I'll call him. Let him sue me for slander if it's not true. He lied faster than a horse could trot. And I'm sure that he would have never taken such an attack on someone that was in the establishment position of being white. There would have never been those attacks, because I know ministers he could have picked on if he wants to look at dishonesty. I know some ministers that have not adopted 8 children as I have. I know some that are driving around new cars. I don't even own one. I know some that are not helping their people to have 4 senior citizen homes, 4 college dormitories, 2 convalescent sanatoriums, and the children's homes and all this humane work that we do. I know plenty that they could have picked on if they'd want to have been looking for dishonesty. But the fact was that it's all right when the man that's already on the inn is prospering. When the man is prospering, it's fine. But when somebody comes along, an old common engine like me, and tells us it's time that blacks and browns prosper too, some folk don't like it, and some of them are in pretty high places. Yeah. So I've taken with a good look at Deputy Mayor Johnson and his freedom to serve the community. And I wouldn't have, I told Mr. Alioda, I said, Mr. Alioda, now I support you. I don't know that I would have supported Mr. Alioda if I hadn't met Mr. Johnson. And I felt I should lay the cards just like that. Because I'm tired, as the man said, I'm tired of poetry, I'm tired of words. I got all kinds of people giving me all kinds of verbiage, you know. They're giving me all kinds of hot air. But it's about time I saw some people putting legs on their prayers and putting some action behind their words. I've often heard it said, it's good to preach Christ, but more so to live Christ in deeds and actions. And so when I walked into that reception the other day, which I'm sure I was there because of the community concern of Mr. Johnson, I said to Mayor Alioda, I said, I'm convinced to support you in your community endeavors because of this man. Because I see here a black man with his talents being recognized and permitted to function. And that's where we need to stick ourselves together, stand together, because united we stand and divided we fall. And I think we also need to know that things aren't getting better just because we say they're getting better. And we don't need to be like an ostrich with his hand in the proverbial, his neck in the proverbial sand. We have to recognize that yellow journalism's not dead. I thought it was, hoped it was, But just in September 16th, I found out that people can lie, and they can do it under the cover of liars with affidavits. Everyone that was quoted in that newspaper had a police record. Everyone. Everyone. From morals charges to immorality against their children. One of them, you heard by her testimony here, was molested when she was a child and in schizophrenic withdrawal. Now she's one of the finest nurses in our community. But her father had made her ill. But the paper, this reverend so-called, picked up the ilk of this type of man who had everything to gain by maligning us, because I guess he was afraid we would tell what we knew about him. And so he bombarded the public with terrible, terrible things. Racist things. Did you see their innuendo? We say, People's Temple says, don't have your natural-born children. And every young couple, the moment they come in, they're not permitted to have their white children. They must adopt a black child. Now, what do you think they were trying to do? What do you think that kind of a maneuver is attempting to do? Obvious racism. And when they printed the headlines, then that particular day, our church was about 60% white on that particular day. And it said, all, nearly all black, the headlines. What do you think they're attempting to do? It's a certain discrediting that's there. And I'm certainly very glad for whatever the majority we have that are black. I wouldn't trade places with all those folks that are proud of the fact that they're white. I'm only with those people today that are white who realize the sin of what the white man has done and wants to make restitution for it. To those, I can walk with them and love them and cooperate with them. But anybody that walks in here that's so proud of being white, I think you ought to take another look at your history. I speak on my own behalf. The persons who have spoken before me do not share my opinions. They're just here as guests of the community. I always feel that it's most important to say that when I've got newsmen around. Not that I have any question about, there was no prior arrangement for anyone to come. It's just a community gesture that people in the various officials will visit the church. We had last week the senator, a very fine senator that was in our ranks, and we had a congressman, and they come repeatedly. That does not mean that they're necessarily in support of our views, but I think I have to give you an honest answer. My honest answer, what do I feel about the Muslims' position on race, is thoroughly this. I cannot absolutely say, because I'm not there, but if it is indeed true that they say all white men are devils, I cannot believe this. I believe that human beings, some are devils, some are angels, mostly in between. Mostly in between. I want to remind you, too, that some of the times when people were needed to serve their fellow beings and go into the courts and go to jail in the early days of our church movement, you look around at some of the white faces here. They were there. When civil rights was so questionable back there in the Midwest, when they threw human feces and they threw garbage and they put dynamite and they marked swastikas on our doors, sliced our tires, put sugar in our gas tanks, stole our batteries, took our wheels off, I want you to know that the people that stood there, 95% of them were white that took that battle on, and they never let down, not one moment. And if you think I'm going to come along with some philosophy and say that all whites are devils, I will not do that. I don't accept it. I just can't accept that. I have a reason to be hurt. My people, my background has suffered just like anyone else that's a minority race. And sometimes you wonder who you can trust. And we know very well, I'm sure, people who've been in official capacity. I've been a government commissioner on human rights. And I could tell how they would treat me when I'd walk in alone, when I walked in with my son. I'm sure the people here who have interracial marriages can know the difference sometimes that they feel. And sometimes it has a cutting edge that you feel like you could hardly stand it. I'm not asleep to the fact that there is still too much racism in this society. But I know one thing, that we cannot have a war between 180 million whites and 20 million blacks. That's suicide. That's suicide. When you teach racial superiority, whether it be black or white, if you teach that one race is superior to another, you've got the same old devil reversed. And it'll lead to the same kind of problems, the same kind of trouble, and the same kind of inroad, self-destruction. Thank you. Anyone else that has a question?
What is your feeling on capital punishment now that it has been...
What is my feeling on capital punishment?
Yes.
Now, as a pastor, that's what gets me in all this trouble. I'm not supposed to get into these fields of legislation. But I invariably get these questions, and I'll honor them. What do I think about capital punishment? Well, I'll speak what the scripture says. Thou shalt not kill. That's what it said. Thou shalt not kill. I say that there's some things you need to look for. Now, under present democratic processes, and I think that we've got a lot of civil libertarians still functioning in American society. But the statute of California says that there are certain crimes punishable by death. One of them, a very vague thing called treason against the state of California. Now that bothers me. Who is the state of California? Today, it's safeguarded by the checks and balances systems of the legislature, the legislative branch, and the executive, and the Supreme Court. But if tomorrow a demagogue comes along in California politics and begins to take over the court by appointments of rascals, like we're seeing in some instances in various places in the world, and the legislature might be said to cause some crisis in our civil life, not necessary. Don't bother with any of this for the moment, will you please, in the aisle? Don't bother with that. So if it's in the Philippines, for instance, the legislature has been told that it's not needed for the time being because of an emergency. I would hate like the dickens to think that Governor Reagan was going to decide what would be treason against the state of California. That'd be my own opinion. I'd hate, and he's not a bad guy in the sense of, I think he's written letters of complimentary nature to our work. In a lot of ways, he shares some real good principles. But he is too much authoritarian for me. I wouldn't want him deciding who has committed treason against the state of California. So that's what I told one of my good friends. I've got a good friend up there in Redwood Valley. You get strange friends in the midst of a battle. You know who come to our rescue? Well, you'd have thought, well, all the civil rights groups would come. Of course, we don't have any up there in the hills. They're nothing but good old farmers. And you'd have thought the good old liberal farmers would have got right in there gung-ho, wouldn't you? You'd have thought they'd have rushed right in there and fought for us hard. You know who one of our greatest supporters was? He'd been in and seen our youth rehabilitated. And he looked and he saw blacks and whites working together. And he knew, because his relatives were in the law enforcement agency, that not one of People's Temple's members had ever been arrested. And when they started after us, who was the first to get a hold of the Attorney General? And the Attorney General didn't know what to think about, because we were being accused of being leftists. The chapter leader of the John Birch Society, Walter Heady, went to battle and wrote the newspaper and said, leave those people alone. I may not agree with where they're going, but they change people's lives for the good, and they make this community a better place. There are no one in trouble. They're good citizens. They don't have any arrest records. They don't use alcohol or tobacco or drugs. So what's wrong with them being alive and permitted to function in our community? You never know. Even for a prophet, that was a hard one to call. Not only did he do that, he got a hold of the head of the Hearst papers. And he got a hold of, well, I'll tell you, some of the people he got a hold of, amazing, made me realize how strong the right is in America today. Because he got a hold of some people that would never take a second look at me. I had people write me that wouldn't, if they'd hear me preach one sermon, they'd have probably dropped dead. But they were writing me sympathetic letters. But again, a lack of communications. Someone told me once Walter Heady hated me. Said he says, you're a socialist. I said, well, if he hates me, we're going to have to go over there and see what's wrong. Because scripture says if your brother has got aught against you, You go to him. Didn't say if he's got aught against you. Said if he's got aught against you, you got to go and find out what the trouble. That's what Scripture. See, I'm an old-fashioned religionist in a lot of ways. I don't dangle you over a hot hell, and I don't always tell you about the streets of gold. But I take some of those ethics of the Judeo-Christian principle very seriously and sincerely to heart. And it says if your brother's got aught against you, you go. So I tromped over to his farm one day and walked in there, and the dogs met me, and the signs, America, love it or leave it, and everything else. I thought, I felt like Abraham in the wilderness. And I walked down for about a half mile, and the more I got there, the more disturbed I got. But when I got the door, I said, I'm Jim Jones. He said, you walked through all these dogs? I said, yes, I did. I get along with dogs better than I do people. He said, well. And so from that point on began a conversation, and it was a conversation that we were miles apart, but there was warmth. And then somebody had a common need. Somebody got in trouble in the community, hurt. They were burned out, and we aided them. We didn't ask what their politics was. And you know, out of that came an understanding. And we began to talk about some of the problems of repression and bureaucracy. And you know, I found out that the John Birch Society was concerned about some of the same laws that threaten civil liberties that you are. They just didn't realize it. There's a racist connotation, but I got him out of that racism. Why, Walter Heddy, he has blacks in his home now. He may be the chapter leader of the John Birch Society, but he's not a segregationist anymore. I might want to change some of his views, but he's no longer a segregationist. If he ever was one. If he ever was one. He isn't now. And it was amazing that during that time of trial, that when liberals wanted to flee, some of them, they wanted to flee because we were getting onslaughts. They were threatening us by night and by day. They kicked a little dog into unconsciousness. They harassed us and broke out our windows. They blasted a shotgun over my head that missed just by, well, I would hate to measure how little it missed by, and 10 or 12 others that were in the parking lot. It was a sorry night that the Hearst Press, I don't think Hearst did it, Mr. Hearst himself sent us a sympathy letter. I want to tell you something, it pays to be good in every front of your life. I don't think that thing would have stopped today, but Mr. Hearst happens to be an anti-vivisectionist, and someone sent him articles saying that we help little animals, and he rushed a letter to the Hearst paper from the Examiner from New York, and Mr. Gould wrote us up there saying, we are going to look into Mr. Kinsolving again. We are sorry if we've caused you any discomfort. And I think your policy and mine of treating little animals kind might have been the thing that touched and stopped us from getting more attacks. I believe those attacks would have kept on and kept on because it took somebody higher than Mr. Kinsolving, because he made a brag to the bishop of our denomination. He made open statements to people at the Pacific School of Religion. He said, I'm going to crush people's temple if it's the last thing I do. So somebody, somewhere, and of course we believe that we know somebody somewhere, but somebody, somewhere, moved a lot of things, because there was a lovely article written in another newspaper about our animal shelter. And when Mr. Hearst read that, you see, everybody's got a heart. Someplace, somebody got sensitivity and feeling everywhere. And you know what we were told? There were two more articles. An editor said, you can be grateful because there were two more articles so filled with lies that someone might have gotten hurt without doubt if they'd been printed, but they were stopped. Now, you know, and I know, that ordinary things don't stop things like that. Ordinary things don't stop things like that. But I want to drop that in to show you just how small the world was. But during that time, what did Mr. Heddy say? He said, I'm not like you, Reverend. You don't believe in his shotgun. But he said, I got one, and if you need it, I'm coming down, and I'm going to park myself on that church lawn. And he said, let him throw another rock. He said, I'll shoot somebody in the rear end. Oh, come on now, child. You may say that's not quite the way you'd have said it, but I loved it. I appreciated him saying it, because nobody was saying anything to me. Folk weren't lifting up the phones. I've had all kinds of folk that knew me during those days before, and they come to me and openly invited me to this and that. But when that trouble hit, you'd be surprised how silent it was. You'd be surprised how the Democratic Party that our church's majority supported all through the years, you'd be surprised even how silent it was. Do you know who came to our rescue again? The head of the Republican Party of the town got a hold of the Attorney General, wrote an article in the newspaper, doctor, because he'd seen our children, he said, those children came to me with their teeth rotting out, and that church paid to straighten their teeth, put on braces, and he said, people that do that kind of work have to be good. And he said, if you're going to come after them, you're going to have to come after me too. I appreciate the chapters in our life. I learned a lot of things. Of course, after Republicans came out, then my Democrat friends came out too. But, with one exception, Deputy Mayor Johnson came right in the midst of the battle. He didn't ask me any questions. Didn't say, what's about this newspaper? Is it true or not? He said, everybody doing things that are good have lies written about them. And I guess Mr. Aliota should surely know, because he's been the most malign person, I suppose, a public official. That caused me to take notice of him, you know. That alone. Just why does he get all these lies told on him? And why is it not mentioned that a jury found him innocent of all charges? Just because he did not get a financial settlement that's not really representing it like it ought to be. That's why I told you the other day you should write Channel 7, because Mr. Coughlin of Channel 7 says it's an unfair treatment that he's getting. And I think it is indeed unfair, because there's not been enough mentioned in the media that this man was proven innocent by two juries.
Right.
But I wasn't asked any questions about, and I'd have been highly offended if I had. Mr. Johnson was a wise man and a kind man. Because if he'd have said, what about those newspapers? I'd have said, Mr. Johnson, if you choose to believe it, you can. If you don't, that's up to you. But he didn't. And thus, he's got a friend from now on. Now, he may not know just how valuable that is, but I'm a scrapper. I'm there. When you give me loyalty when I need it, I'll be behind you. If after Mr. Aliota has decided he doesn't want to run anymore and you want to run for mayor, I'll be right there pushing. Because Republicans have something in common. They never forget. Never forget. I never forget kindness. Particularly when it's not going to do you anything, not going to gain you anything. He didn't have a thing to gain by being kind to us, but just was kind. He didn't know how much we stand together. He didn't know how unified we are. He didn't know that if they come after one of us, if they'd ever want to take away liberty in this country, if they ever wanted to take away freedom as they did to the Jews in Nazi Germany, if some terrible misfortune would take place, that they came to do that sort of thing, if they came after one of us, they'd have to take every blessed one of us.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
Thank you. Thank you. And we aren't all here tonight, because some of them are managing children's homes and managing senior citizen homes. Some of them are in college classes, and some in the nursing convalescent homes. Some of them are in the various projects managing the concession stands at the city. We're in various roles and functions, and a whole lot of Los Angeles is not here, and a whole lot of Seattle that's coming in tomorrow. When you get us all together, about 10,000 of us, and that's no small number. Believe in the democratic process, and we're going to stand by it. We're nonviolent, and we're going to stand by it. So in answer to you, dear, I don't believe in killing. I don't believe it's brought us any good thing in society. I don't believe wars have gotten us very far. I think we're going to have to learn how to win with ideas. If I had listened to what they said to me about the John Birch man, I suppose we could have been in a battle, because he really said we ought to be driven out of the neighborhood. But I walked up, and I didn't carry a gun. I came with an honest heart, and he had an honest heart, and two honest hearts met. So I am afraid of killing, because so often in the state's background, not this state, every state, the ones that end up in the gas chamber and the gallows and the execution chambers are black brown, or poor white. That there's never been a person ever executed that had $50,000 in liquid assets until they start all those rich folks as well as they kill all the poor folks. I'm not for capital punishment.
All right.
I mean, a criminal's a criminal. If you're going to get... I noticed someone, a famous right-wing racist today who's using... he's a cartoonist. And he was involved in sodomy and involved in a morals charge. And up in two different universities, they had him clear. They pinned his head to the wall. I've never been arrested in my life. Never done anything that I want to, anybody would hesitate for anybody to know. But I've got all kinds of malarkey thrown at me. And you've had it too if you've been standing for what you believe. But you know that guy, strangely enough, he didn't get a day's sentence. He didn't get a court to even hear the case. Judge just threw it out, and yet he was proven guilty in Wisconsin and in Louisiana. He had all the evidence against him. An act of immorality against a minor. His money bought him out. When money can buy people justice, I'm afraid of laws that takes anyone's life. And I think you'll have to look at it from the criminologist standpoint. The head of the local prison said that he believes, and many say, that it is not a deterrent to murder or any other capital crime that has been covered by the gas chamber. Let's look at the young child in San Jose who was a babysitter. She didn't have the courage, she said, to commit suicide, so she murdered two children so that the state would take the problem out of her hands and kill her. And I think you'll find a lot of people like that. The states that have done away with capital crimes have no more crimes of violence and acts of passion than the states that have them. In fact, if anything, there are less capital offenses in states that have done away with capital punishment. So if you want to look at it just practically, I say we ought to really worry people with the fact that they could be in prison a long, long time. I think that will deter people. But death, sometimes when you're killing someone else, it's an act of suicide, you know, just self-destruction, an impulse to be destroyed. So I would say, if you're going to be Christian and follow the Judeo-Christian tradition, no. No to the death penalty. No. But if you are also going to look at it just from a practical standpoint, no. In fact, the matter, I believe with Jefferson, that good Democrat that said, the government that governs least governs best. Got to watch government when it gets too many laws. History, that is, shows that governments, when you give them too many laws, they don't always...